Hello. This is Peter Jacoby for Profiles, ready to welcome into our studio a remarkably facile and stylistically flexible pianist, Jeanette Cuckoo. It's a wonderful name, and she's a great talent. I've heard this fine musician play the César Franck Piano Quintet with the Biava Quartet, the Bartók Piano Quintet with the Penderecki Quartet, and violin piano sonatas by Mozart and Charles Ives with the violinist William Harvey. I want to welcome you, Jeanette Cuckoo.
Thank you.
Please tell me, first of all, about the name. I love it. K-O-E-K, K-O-E-K. Where does it come from?
It's a Dutch name. And the Kuckoek in Dutch is the cuckoo bird. So I can't help it. I have
That's
that
great.
Name.
Well, it's like a cuckoo clock.
That's what it is, yeah.
Yeah.
I've sure made, you know, they made fun of me in school.
Well, nobody makes fun of you now because you've got a great talent. Tell me how you managed to tackle such different musics and make a strong case for each.
I decided last year that I would really like to do something different because I feel as an as a musician, you know, you of course you play the repertoire that you that everybody knows, but there's so much wonderful music that is not often performed, usually because it's very difficult or takes more time to learn. I talked to Mimi Zweig about doing all the Ives sonatas, and she thought it was a great idea.
She's who brings you here for the
yes.
IU String Academy.
Yes. Then the Penderecki's asked me for the Bartók, saying, you know, we really for years have been wanting to do this, but there's no pianist that really wants to spend the time learning this piece. And that is really, I mean, that was a piece I lay awake over, I can tell you.
Imagine.
And I think I can manage because I always feel the piece I'm actually learning or the piece that I'm performing is the most wonderful piece I'm playing now. I don't have a preference for a certain style or a certain composer. I just don't. So I can adapt as easily to a modern piece as to early music, which I love too, and anything in between.
Well, I was given a quote of yours. I want to move the listener with my playing. Whether they love it or hate it or get upset, what is most important to me is that they feel and have a meaningful experience.
That's right.
Yeah. And you really believe that?
I really believe that, yeah. When I go on stage, my sole purpose is to give them whatever I have and communicate something to them. And I realize very well that, you know, I'm giving my opinion about things or ours, you know, if I'm playing with other people together. And sometimes, you know, of course, they're not going to like it, but I'd rather have them, you know, not liking it or upset than going out the door the same way as they came in.
Mm-hmm.
I want – really, it is the communication and transmitting the emotions that are in the music that I find the most interesting. That's why I'm doing it. Otherwise, I would do something else.
Well, to take the two quintets that you performed here recently, the César Franck and the Béla Bartók, tell me a little bit about how you feel those pieces work emotionally.
Well, the Franck is actually my favorite piano quintet. It is pianistically extremely well written. And I feel it's very romantic, but it goes sort of to the edge of what, you know, the instrument or the string quartet or the whole quintet can produce. It's very charged. And with a gorgeous second movement that is just wonderful. And it's romantic. I mean, it has feelings of love and, you know, everything that goes with it. The Bartók, I find, that moves me on a totally different level. It still has, because it's an early work, it still has a lot of the romantic styles that he sort of was experiencing at that time. But on every page, there are a few chords or rhythms that pop out and where you hear that's where he will be 30 years from now or 20 years from now, and which is, you know, like the string quartets, for example, or the two violin sonatas. Bartók has always moved me. I can't very well describe what it is exactly that moves me, but it's something old and ancient that has been, that is transmitted through the music, I feel.
And it's your purpose to convey that feeling to others.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, to honor what the composer wrote down, which is in itself, especially with this piece, just already quite a lot of work. But I'm only happy when I can get beyond that and really feel that I can transmit the feelings of it.
You also are quite wide-ranging in the concertizing you do. I mean, you do a lot of chamber music and have actually formed several groups. And then you do recitals, and then you do solos with orchestras.
Yep.
Do you have a preference there, or just get involved with whatever you're doing at the moment?
I used to do that. You know, I used to sort of do everything. Although I must say, in the last couple of years, I do really think my heart is in chamber music. I love to give a recital. If I would be doing it all the time, I would be bored. Because I feel I'm communicating with myself and the composer, and I'm with myself all the time. And honestly, what interests me more is to have an interaction with somebody else and feel what they're saying and you know, have an interaction and communication. And because then I feel that the music still is new, that you're not reproducing whatever you've been doing before. And I find in the solo repertoire that is much harder to do. As though there's wonderful piano music written, and if I do give a recital, I feel that every time. But it's different for me. Mm-hmm.
Well, we know you most in Bloomington as a collaborator, because that's the way we've seen you and heard you.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a sense of how much you love that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, of course, you do teaching.
Yes.
Here in Bloomington, you're involved with the String Academy. And in Tuscany, in Italy, where you make your home now, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You have an academy as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well,
and about teaching, what that means to you?
I love teaching. I can say that I'm never bored with giving a lesson. I feel you learn and you see a new person, or the information that they bring is different or new. And what I'm really interested in is to take a student from A to B. That can be from level 2 to 5. It could also mean from level 9 to 10. But it is the development that really interests me, to get them to the next level and make them as free as possible doing what they're doing. And in Tuscany, I do courses. They're private courses, so people email me or call me, and then they say, for example, the first week of March, are you there? Yes, I'm there. And then they'll come for a week and have 2 lessons a day, very intense, like almost 3-4 hours lessons. And the only thing they'll do is practice, have lessons, eat and sleep, and sit on a mountaintop in an ancient borgo. And I feel the real advantage of that is that, first of all, you can be with the whole process that a student has. It's not that they come ready and, you know, you see them once a week and you add a few things and they still, the next week, have to work that out by themselves. If you are there every step of the way in a short, compressed period, they can't drift off, you know, and not apply the information correctly. So it's a real pressure cooker. And I think the second thing that helps to it too is that being in such a different area and in such a remote place, it pulls them out of their normal situation where they can hang on to. It's like you're in a different century almost when you're there. And that makes them susceptible to change.
For how long do they come?
Usually for 1 week or 2 weeks, but usually it's 1 week.
And you do this the year round or certain parts of the year? Or
I do this year round. I mean, it's, of course, I mean, since I'm playing a lot of concerts too, I would never be able to say, okay, I'll, you know, be there a couple of months. I just can't. And I find this is for me the solution to be able to teach mm-hmm. and help students and still do what I want to do, concertizing.
And the students come from all over?
I've had them now from the States, from Germany, from Holland. I know one from England is coming. They're literally from all over, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's take a short break in our conversation and go to some music. You've selected three things that we want to get to at mm-hmm. some point during the hour. And we thought first to turn to two songs of Charles Ives, mm-hmm. that it's a recording you made a year ago. So tell us about it and what we might hear.
This is sort of the project that got me hooked on Ives. Jill Feldman is a wonderful singer that happens to live on the next mountain in Tuscany. And it's total coincidence. She is originally an early music singer, but she just wanted, being an American, wanted to record these Ives songs and said, would you want to do it? I love this music. I really do. And I think the songs that I chose are the songs my mother taught me, and the Housatonic at Stockbridge, which I find one of the most moving pieces that I ever heard.
Combination of singer Jill Feldman and pianist Jeanette Cuckoo. Jeanette is in our studio in Bloomington today, and they have done two songs of Charles Ives. Let's turn backward, Jeanette, now to your personal history, mm-hmm. to your childhood, and how and when music first came into your life.
There was a piano at the house. There was an old
piano.
And this
was where?
This was in Holland in a small town. From what I understand, my parents told me later, is that I was 3 and a half and just there was a – they had a record of Ingrid Heibler playing the Haydn concertos.
Oh, my.
And I tried to play that on the piano. I heard it and I just tried to get that out of the piano. So that's when they realized maybe we should find a teacher for this girl. But in those days, teaching of young children was not at all a big thing, and certainly not for piano. So they found me a teacher who, this was I'll never forget her, a lady with incredibly blonde hair and red lipstick. That's what I remember most, who taught violin, piano, the recorder, theory. I mean, she must have been incredibly capable. And so she was willing to teach me at the age of 4, which was very young. Most of her students, she didn't start before 7 or 8. And that's how I got started. What I really wanted to play was the violin. But, of course, there wasn't a violin in the house. And then I wanted to go to a music school in the town. And there was no place. There was no place available for another student playing the violin. So I stuck with the piano and the recorder.
Was there anyone else in the family that was engaged in music?
Or? Not at all. I mean, they like music, but not nearly to the level. They can do without as well, and I can't.
And you really took to it? I mean, you enjoyed doing music?
I already knew then that I wanted to be a musician. There was no doubt for me.
And then that led to advanced study. Tell us about that, would you?
Well, I when I was 12 or 13, we moved to Rotterdam. And there was a teacher there who studied with Rudolf Serkin and Leon Fleischer. So he was really a very good teacher. And he didn't, you know, watch the time too much. So his lessons would be a lesson and then listen to recordings of Fleischer and Arau and Serkin. And I mean, I learned so much from that man just about what was going on in the world musically, because I was raised very isolated, very secluded. So I had no way of knowing, you know, even what was going on. Then I went to the conservatory in Amsterdam, where I was with a very good teacher named Jan Wijn. I really wanted to have lessons with Misha Dichter. That's what I had decided when I was 13. Now, Misha gave concerts, but I think he has never, ever given a lesson in his life, and he certainly wasn't going to. So after my repetitive asking, because I played in a masterclass for him and he was interested, he said, I'm not going to teach you, but you have to go to my teacher, Albi Cerco, in Los Angeles. So I did. I knew he was in Aspen. I applied thinking, you know, I didn't have the money nor thinking that I would be getting in. But I did, and I found the money and studied for 2.5 months with this man, and he changed my life. Musically, he honestly changed my life. And after that, I decided to go with a scholarship from the Dutch government to study 2 years in Los Angeles, which I did kind of in the same way I'm teaching now. I went for 2 weeks, then went home for 2 months, then went back for 2 weeks. So I could still work, because I was already working in Holland a little bit, work and at the same time build repertoire and learn from this man. So there's not a day that I don't think about him.
What was so special about him and his training?
I'll give you an example. One of the things that I brought him was the late Schubert sonatas, of which the A major, the big one. And the second movement, there was a lesson where he, for 2 hours, tried on the first eight measures, tried to get me to really bring out what was in the music. And I felt hopeless. I thought, I'm never going to get it. And what is he after? And then he would send me home. And the next morning at 7 o'clock, I was practicing again. And at 9, he would call me, say, get over here. And I would play the same eight measures. And I'll never forget, he had this little smirk on his face. And he said, I see you're beginning to understand it. And it was really a profound understanding of music. And for me, in his teaching, technique, music, and, you know, what's in music that transcends us, he was able to make that all together, to make it possible for me to every piece after that I would be playing or learning, I could apply the same principles and get to the same level of connection with the music. And that was very important for me.
So I really see a two-step. Your earlier teacher giving you the opportunity to listen,
yeah,
to hear great pianists, and then the application came later.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And you think then that's what students should do? Do you try to do that with your own students?
Actually, I do. I mean, you make me think of something now, but because I. When I feel that they don't get something that I'm after, I do have, you know, DVDs and recordings, and I pull them out and let them listen to it right then and there. I listen with them and I explain it to them. And I think in my teaching, I would say that I really, the principles I learned from Albi Cerco, I apply 100%. And they work.
What do you learn from your own students?
Well, first of all, other opinions. You know, they bring me a piece of music that I might have played myself, and they do it in a very different way. And you learn very quickly that, you know, there's not one road that leads to Rome. There are a lot of ways at work. The process of mastering the instrument and how difficult it can be to just, you know, be your own person and do what you want to do, which is actually a struggle for most, I think.
Absolutely. It is in any field, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
As you strive to get better. Well, let's turn to some more music, and it's Beethoven this time, mm-hmm. The Opus 111 Sonata, second movement, played by, I guess, somebody you think a great deal of, Arthur Schnabel.
Yes, yeah.
Talk to me about that choice, would you?
Well, Obi Tserko was a Schnabel student. I mean, when I hear Schnabel play Beethoven, it is the only way I feel that it should be played. He has such an exquisite understanding of the music and is able to do what Beethoven asks and still have this incredible timing and sound that are flexible. I have the utmost respect for his playing.
Second movement of the Beethoven Sonata, Opus 111, as played by the great Arthur Schnabel, who is an idol of our guest in the studio today, Jeanette Cuckoo. Did you know early on that you knew that you wanted to do music professionally? Did you think also that you could make it?
I think so, mm-hmm. Yeah. I must have always – I mean, I had my doubts, of course, and, you know, the mind, the brain
sure.
speaking. And but something inside me told me that this is what I would be doing and that I would be good at it.
And you are. How much time do you take practicing each day?
This is something my students shouldn't hear.
Oh.
Because I'm a weird practicer in the sense that I don't do many hours. I read very quickly. So I think that skips a lot of the practicing where you sort of, you know, get the notes. I would say 2 hours.
Hmm.
And if I really have a lot of repertoire to learn, okay, I might get to 3, but that's it.
But do you try to get it in every day?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And do you ever get tired of that?
Or? Yes. Yeah. I do. Well, if I have, for example, in October, it looks like I won't have a concert then. Well, then I'll be sitting on my horse. You know, it's not that I have this urge to play the piano if I don't have a reason for it. Although I might, you know, every now and then play a Chopin Nocturne or read a Schubert Sonata just for my fun. That's, I think, the only disadvantage from this profession is that you do it so often and you have to learn so much that sometimes you forget that it's actually nice to just read for your own pleasure or, you know, read music that you don't know or haven't played. And I think it's actually important.
It's like a writer reading.
Yeah, yeah, indeed,
sure.
Yeah.
Now, you said that you'd been away from home for 7.5 weeks and you missed your animals. You just mentioned a horse.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of animals do you have back in Tuscany?
I have 4 dogs, 3 horses, and 5 cats.
And who takes care of them while you're gone?
My husband, Tony, does.
What does your husband do?
He is retired right now. But he was a crisis manager for big companies. Oh. And he's incredibly clever, has an understanding of music which amazes me. He knows more facts about music than I do. And he's my worst critic, which is good.
It's very good.
Yeah.
So I guess you miss him as well as the animals.
I do. But as I say, you know, I can talk to him on the phone, but that's not right. To the animals.
Let's talk a little bit about process. When you approach a new piece of music and want to build it into your repertoire, how do you go about it?
Well, first I make a choice if it's something I have the time to learn or if it's, you know, short and I have to get there as quickly as possible. If I have the time to learn it, what I like to do is just once a day read through it. Just then do something else. Second day, do that again. And I always feel like if I do that very slowly and right away with the right notes and looking at what's dynamically, so I incorporate everything at the same time, it's like a ripening process. And usually the technical problems are solved by just starting slowly and repeating it, and then I get there. If I need to learn it in a faster way, then I do incorporate listening to recordings, if they exist, just to get a musical idea quicker. So then you skip a step. I must say, it's not the process I prefer. I prefer the other way because it becomes more of your own, I feel. And if you do it the second way, you produce, but then the actual understanding might follow after.
One of the mysteries to an outsider is how musicians can come together, like in a chamber music situation, and unify into the kind of performance that we hear. Mm-hmm. Let's just take one of the situations that I heard you do in recent weeks, either the Bartók with the Penderecki or the César Franck with the Biava. Could you take us through how you came together to shape what we ultimately heard?
Well, the Franck and the Bartók had a very different process because Franck is known repertoire to most string quartets and to most pianists, I think. So there's a preconceived idea already about how it should sound. I personally, if that's the case, like to rehearse as little as possible. Once, maybe twice, and then go on stage and just be very alert, listen to what's going on. So it's still fresh. I don't like to make deals. Like, okay, there we do this, there we do this, there we do this. I mean, that's, for me, it takes a little of the spontaneity out of the music. And it does, then you're stuck. It doesn't allow things to happen that you might not have thought of and can happen. They can be good, they can be bad, but they're usually good. The Bartók, there was a totally different process. I went to Canada the last week of May, where the Penderecki is resided, and was doing some teaching there and masterclass, and in the meantime rehearsing, because this piece, none of us knew. Each part has a different thing going on, or each one. So that took a lot of hours. We had probably 3, 4, 5 rehearsals over there and a few more over here. We've performed it over there as well. And I must say that performing is actually helps the most, because then you really know what it sounds like, what you're going to do and what the others do. So I find the first rehearsal after a performance is the most useful one.
There is a welcoming process, though, isn't there? I mean, you're the outsider.
Mm-hmm.
The Biava Quartet is a unit.
Yeah.
Penderecki is a unit.
Yeah.
And you're the visitor, the guest. Do you find that difficult, or does it depend upon the group? Or
I think it does depend upon the group. I must say, with both these quartets, I haven't felt an outsider, not a one single minute. Maybe because, you know, I know them now, but also the first time. It's just, I feel if you, there's, you know, there's a group sense, there's a group feeling. And if you just connect with that right away and you don't put yourself, you know, above them or tell them how to do it, which sometimes happens too, I hear. You know, you're open. It's a collaboration. You're open to their opinions and they're open to yours. And both of them I have never had any problems with.
And that has something to do probably also with how good they are as musicians.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're assured of their own.
Well, the problems arise when you ask somebody to do something that they're not able to do. Mm-hmm. And or that they feel insecure doing. And that was not the case at all in, with the Frank or the Bartok.
Well, let's do one more piece of music.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Schubert, the C major quintet. And you've chosen Rostropovich. Tell us why that particular piece and why that particular recording.
Well, I was thinking, you know, as I like so many pieces and so much music, I had a real hard time choosing. And my dear friend Mimi Zweig, she said, well, what was the first record you ever listened to? And that was this record. We happened to have, I think, maybe 10 LPs in the house. But one was this Schubert quintet. And I remember even when being in high school, you know, having to learn Latin and Greek and just sitting there, that I would just listen to either the Brandenburg Concertos by Bach or the Schubert Quintet in order to regain my mental sanity. And I still think it's one of the most beautiful chamber music pieces ever.
Second movement of the Schubert C major quintet, Rostropovich, in a recording chosen by Jeanette Kukuk, who is our guest in the studio today. You perform in various countries.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of a citizen of the world, too, Dutch and Italian and American and what have you. Do you find differences in audiences from country to country or just place to place or from kind of concert to kind of concert?
I would say there is a difference in countries. What I find in Holland is people are, you know, it's a northern country. They're a little more reserved in expressing their feelings than, for example, in Italy, where you literally feel the warmth. You feel what if they love it, and boy, do they let you know.
Well, they've got opera in their blood, too.
Oh, totally. They're so open in it. And I must admit that really the most wonderful concerts that I've – where I have really the most wonderful memories of were in Italy. Because it's almost like they take part in your experience, in what you're they're open to it. And here in America, it's different, too. People are, I think, more – appreciative of classical music in general, I find. Well, maybe here. I mean, I must say, here people walk up to you much quicker to tell you what they thought of it. Like after a concert, you know, there's this line of people just, and they'll just talk to you. In Holland, you know, if there's maybe one or two, you don't do that. You know, it's private. So that is a different.
And do you respond then differently to those different audiences?
Yeah. I think it has an effect on you, yes. I mean, basically, when I walk out on stage, I feel an audience. It's you know, I walk out and they say hello by applauding, and I say hello by bowing. In the meantime, you know, the communication has started. So when in Holland, I've had experiences where I would think that they weren't really interested or they didn't really care for it that much. But you can be really fooled by that, because later on, if the people that do tell you what they thought of it, they were actually, you know, really into it. But it's just a general way of being as a country or as a nation, I think, that prevents them from expressing that.
Let's go back to teaching. You say you love it.
Yes.
I'd like a little bit more about what it does for you and what you attempt to accomplish.
What I try to make them understand and do is, first of all, understanding of the instrument. If I'm teaching piano, if I'm teaching violin, that's less of my job, of course. But to be technically as free as possible, because I think techniques is just a mean. It's definitely not the goal. But in order to be expressive with your music, you have to be...
You have to have it.
You have to have it. You know, it's, as my teacher in Amsterdam said, is technique is 1A and music is 1B. Then the second thing I try to accomplish is that they have a true understanding of the music coming from the page. You know, they so often get into feeling this and feeling that, but if you ask why, they don't have an answer. And I find the answer, you know, well, I feel it that way, to be a very bad one. I think they should really honor what is written by the composer, detail. Third, what I would like to accomplish is I have often also professional pianists that, you know, do competitions or recitals or have to do their final exam. Being on a stage is an issue because it's different, you know, just playing it in your own room or performing it. And so the aspect of how you perform and how you deal with being on stage, how you deal with an audience, how you prepare for it before a concert, that you say, you know, whatever you think, you say thank you afterwards if people come up to you and you don't express right away your personal feelings about it. All that I find part of the education as well.
There's so many fine young talents, mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yes.
Far more than the profession can support,
yeah.
Probably. Does that concern you? Or?
It does. It does. Actually, it's a question that I probably don't have an answer to, but I sometimes wonder, as, you know, methods of teaching get better, you know, really good teachers are sometimes able to make somebody play an instrument really well just by having them trained extremely correctly and the students being able to practice and work it very, very, very hard. You know, this does not make them musicians. I feel that there's a lot of danger in that, in a way, because if they were able to look at it this way, like they would go through their lives, become engineer, whatever, and have this great hobby, I'm the first one to say that is just the best thing in the world because they have music all their life. They can do what they want. But since they're usually parents behind it that have other ideas, you know, they have to become professionals and it's a battle. And I don't know how much, you know, as a teacher you should be feeling responsible for that because, you know, you're doing what you're doing. You're teaching. You do it well, so they come out well.
That's your job.
It's your job. But if I look at it from more of a distance, I think sometimes, you know, there are so many schools, there's so many teachers, and all these musicians put out in the world, and only very few are actually going to end up doing it.
But for all the rest, I mean, there would be disappointments, obviously, but they will have the enjoyment, the pleasure of music, and they will have discipline also.
Yes.
They can employ elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And like I say, if they, for example, the VV kids of Mimi, they have such an incredible experience going through, you know, the years that they can play together, they go on tours, they have friends, they have fun together. from that, whether they become a professional violinist or not is really not a major issue. And some of them don't, and they still love playing the violin. And then it's great.
We're about to run out of time, but I want to ask you one more question. What does music mean to you?
My soul, the essence, the core of what is in human life possible for me.
That says a great deal. I want to thank you for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
In the WFIU studio today. Our guest has been Jeanette Cuckoo, and I want to thank her again. And I want to thank you, our listeners out there. This is Peter Jacoby for Profiles.
The program you have just heard was recorded in July of 2008. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.